Okay, we're going into Proverbs chapter 30 now, and in this session we'll plan to finish the book, chapters 30 and 31. The previous Proverbs have not been associated with any name except Solomon's, though it is believed that some other people may have written some of the other Proverbs. Since not all of them are said to be Solomon's, but many of them are, any of the Proverbs in chapters 1 through 29... which were not written by Solomon, were anonymous. But here we have two chapters which were not written by Solomon, where the author's names are given to us. In chapter 30, Agur is the man's name, and in chapter 31, it's Lemuel, or King Lemuel. We don't know who either of these people were. King Lemuel does not correspond with the name of any of the kings of Judah that are known. Some have felt like Lemuel might be a poetic name for Solomon, But that's just a guess. We don't really know who Lemuel was or who Agur was. But each of them wrote us a chapter. And we'll read chapter 30, which says, "The words of Agur, the son of Jacob, even the prophecy. The man spake unto Ithiel and Ucal." So those are the people that this was spoken to, but we don't know who they were either. But they apparently wrote it down. He said, "Surely I am more stupid than any man." The word brutish means stupid. "Surely I am more stupid than any man, and I have not the understanding of a man. I neither learned wisdom, nor have the knowledge of the holy. Who hath ascended into heaven, or descended? Who hath gathered the wind in his fists? Who hath bound the waters in a garment? Who hath established all the ends of the earth? What is his name, and what is his son's name, if thou canst tell?" Now, this man said that he doesn't have wisdom and he doesn't even know God. And he wasn't Jewish, apparently. Well, maybe he was. It's hard to say. But he wasn't one of the Jewish kings. And when he says, "I don't have the knowledge of the holy or knowledge of God, I haven't learned wisdom," he might just be seeking to be humble here. He might really have considerable knowledge of wisdom and of the knowledge of God, but realize that the more that a person learns, the more they realize there is that they don't know. And so Paul had said in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, if any man thinks he knows anything thoroughly, he knows nothing as he ought to know. So maybe this man really was more knowledgeable than he's letting on. But he says he's stupid. So he's more stupid than other men. He doesn't have the understanding even of a human being. He lacks wisdom and he lacks the knowledge of God. But again, this might simply be a way of saying there's so much more that he needs to learn, that he just feels stupid and that he feels unknowledgeable and feels unqualified even to speak wisdom such as this. Now, in verse 4, he says, who has ascended up into heaven or descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who hath bound the waters in a garment? Who hath established all the ends of the earth? What is his name, and what is his son's name, if thou canst tell?" I've heard many Christians try to make this be a reference to Jesus. They say, "What is his name? Well, that must be God. What's his son's name? That must be a reference to Jesus." And the reason they believe it's talking about God and his son Jesus is because it talks about who has bound the waters as a garment, who has established all the ends of the earth. Well, the answer to that question would be God. However, the way it's being posed, basically what he says, what man has done these things? If there's such a man, I'd like to know who he is. That's what he's saying here. He's not saying who is God. He's saying who is man? What man is he that has ascended up into heaven or descended? Do we know any men like that, he's saying? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Only God can do that. What man has done that? Who has bound the waters in a garment? Who has established the ends of the earth? It's sort of like when God asked Job, "Did you do these things?" Showing that man is so much inferior to God. And when he says, "What is his name?" it doesn't mean, "What is God's name?" "What is his son's name?" doesn't mean, "What is God's son's name?" What it means is there any man who has done any of these things? If so, I want to know who he is. What's his name? Write it down here. Tell me what his son's name is while you're at it, too. And it's just a Jewish way of speaking, even as when it talks about, in the Old Testament, it speaks of the Son of Man. It's not usually talking about Jesus, though Jesus used that term for himself. But most of the Proverbs and Psalms that refer to the Son of Man simply refer to, it speaks of man and the Son of Man, usually. And, of course, the Son of Man just simply emphasizes the humanness of it, as here, what is his name and what's his son's name? Again, it's not referring to a particular man or his own son. It's referring just to the fact that whoever it is, he'd be some man, and his son would be something else too. Verse 5 and 6. Every word of God is pure. Apparently in contrast to the words of Agur, who feels himself to be unknowledgeable and so forth. But God's word is pure. Every word of his is pure. He is a shield unto them that put their trust in him. Add thou not unto his words, lest he reprove thee and thou be found a liar. We remember that Eve made this mistake in the garden, that she added to the words of God. And she had received a commandment from God, but she changed it a bit by adding to it, making it more severe than God had. And she came into a place of where she fell because she lost track of what was God's words and what were her own additions. And we need to realize that the Word of God stands in a class by itself. We don't have the right to add to it. Now, this doesn't mean don't write any more books of the Bible, as in Revelation, where it says, he that adds to the words of this book shall have the plagues of this book added unto him, and he that takes away from the words of this book, his name shall be taken out of the book of life. Many people have felt that that means there should be no more books of the Bible written after that. However, there's a good chance that the Gospel of John was written after that. So we have to understand that in Revelation, when it makes that statement, it's not necessarily saying that no more books of the Bible should be written, because, as I said, at least one book of the Bible certainly was written after that. That'd be the Gospel of John. And it's only saying don't add more to that book of Revelation, or the plagues of that book of Revelation will be added to you. Here, where it says don't add to God's words, again, it's not saying don't write any more books of the Bible. If that's what it meant, we would be in trouble because we wouldn't have any New Testament or any of the prophets, because they were written after this point. But it's saying that you should not alter his words. You should not mix his words with your own ideas. You shouldn't add to the concepts, your own concepts, and intermix them so that you lose track, because you'll be found a liar when he reproves you. Now, verses 7 through 9. Two things have I required of thee. Deny them not before I die. Already he's got problems. He wants two things. David said in Psalm 27:4, one thing have I desired of the Lord. What will I seek? I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, and behold the goodness of the Lord, the beauty of the Lord. Now, David only wanted one thing, but Agur wants two things. He says, two things I've required. Deny me them not before I die. Here's the two things. Remove far from me vanity and lies. That's the first thing. Now, that probably doesn't mean help me not to be a liar. It probably means rid me of the presence of lying men. That's usually what that kind of wording in the Bible refers to. Remove far from me vanity and lies. In other words, don't make me hear the lies of liars. And the other thing is give me neither poverty nor riches. And the reason he gives here is feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain. Now he's saying that he doesn't want to be rich or poor because he can't handle either. If he's poor, he's going to be tempted to steal. And if he does that, it's like taking the name of the Lord in vain. He's calling himself one of the Lord's people and he's not seen like one of the Lord's people. It's taking the name of the Lord upon him emptily. And so that's a bad thing. He doesn't want to be in the position to steal, so he doesn't want to be poor. On the other hand, we might think him rather humble because he doesn't want to be rich. You see, he doesn't want to be rich because then he'd trust in his riches. He would say, who is the Lord? I don't need the Lord anymore. I've got my bank account. And so he doesn't want either of those temptations. Now, let's think that this is a very desirable thing to pray. We need to realize that the Apostle Paul said in Philippians chapter 4, I have learned how to be full and how to be empty. I have learned how to be abased and how to abound. He said, I am instructed, no matter what state I am, therewith to be content. So Paul was saying that he had learned how he could be poor successfully or rich successfully. If he was rich, he wouldn't let it affect his walk with God. If he were going through a poverty state, he wouldn't let that affect negatively his walk with God. Those states of life, poverty and riches, or middle class, those things should not be able to affect our walk with God. Agur was a weak individual. He was seeking the essence of temptation. He didn't want any more liars around him. He was getting, and he didn't want the influence to of riches or the influence of poverty that might draw him away from God. His walk with God was not particularly strong. And so we don't necessarily take him as an example for ourselves here. So he definitely wanted to be, he wanted to stay middle class. Verse 10, accuse not a servant unto his master, lest he curse thee, and I'll be found guilty. Now that's interesting. Reminds me of Doeg in 1 Samuel 22. 1 Samuel 22, you remember David was fleeing from Saul and he came to the house of God at Nob. And he was looking for food. And the priest said, we only have showbread here. We don't have any common bread. David said, I'll take that. And he gave it to the men with him. And they ate it. And he took Goliath's sword also. And then he went his way. And there was a man named Doeg there who was an Edomite who decided to try to get favors from King Saul. And so he told him about this priest, how that the priest had done this and had given David this food and all. And so Saul had the priests executed, and Doeg was seeking favors from the king. In fact, by Jewish tradition, Doeg became Saul's armor bearer as the result of this. He was promoted. But the interesting thing about that is that when Saul died, he fell on his own sword, and his armor bearer fell on his own sword too. And if that was Doeg, Doeg perished with Saul. But the idea here is a man who accuses a servant, his master. David was Saul's servant. David was not the king yet. David was a servant of Saul. But Doeg was accusing his servant to his master, seeking favors with the master himself, because that he himself came under a curse, Doeg did, and was found guilty. And there are other kinds of examples that could be thought of for that too. Now there's verses 11 through 14. Each of them start by saying, there is a generation. Now the word generation there means a family or a race of people. It doesn't mean a period of time. It means a group, a family or a nation of people. And it's interesting, as we read these four things in verses 11 through 14 that describe this generation, that it corresponds very properly with the generation of vipers that Jesus spoke about. That was the Pharisees in Matthew 3:7. John the Baptist called them a generation of vipers in Matthew 3:7. And Jesus called them that in Matthew 23. He called them a generation of vipers, meaning the offspring of a serpent. That's what they called them. A generation of vipers is basically the offspring of snakes. And so there is a generation means there is an offspring. There is a family. And these are their characteristics. But look at their characteristics. Each one of these four things corresponds to something that Jesus said the Pharisees did. He said in verse 11, there is a generation that curses their father and does not bless their mother. In Matthew 15, verses 4 through 6, Jesus accused the Pharisees of this very thing, of how they violated the command to honor your father and your mother. And they found loopholes through their traditions by which a man could avoid blessing his parents if he didn't want to bless them. So we find the description there of the Pharisees in verse 11. Verse 12, there's a generation that are pure in their own eyes, and yet is not washed from their filthiness. Obviously, we have examples of that in the New Testament, like the Pharisee who was standing praying next to a publican. He said, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. I'm not like this tax collector here, because I tithe twice a week, and I pay my tithes, I fast twice a week, I keep the law. He was clean in his own eyes, yet he was not washed from his filthiness. Verse 13, there is a generation. Oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up, as their nose was in the air. Jesus spoke of the Pharisees like that, in speaking of their pride and all, in Matthew chapter 23, verses 5 through 7. And there he said, but all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries. They enlarge the borders of their garments. They love the uppermost rooms in the feasts and the chief seats in the synagogues, and greetings in the market, and people be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. This is that generation that their eyes are so lofty, they're so proud and arrogant, and think so highly of themselves and want others to do so also. Verse 14, there's a generation whose teeth are as swords, and their jaw teeth as knives to devour the poor from off the earth and the needy from among men. Jesus said of the Pharisees in Matthew 23:14, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayer. Therefore you shall receive a greater damnation." He said they devour the estates of widows. Here it says these people have jaw teeth like knives and teeth like swords, and they devour the poor from off the earth, which is what the widows were, and the needy from among men. So it's interesting how these four things, there is a generation that fits this description. And Jesus gave all these features as examples of what the Pharisees do and called them a generation of vipers, an offspring of serpents. Just sort of an interesting parallel. I don't know really how much significance to draw from it, but I find it rather interesting. Verse 15, "The horse leech has two daughters, crying, 'Give, give.'" Now a leech, of course, is a parasite. "Has two daughters," or things that are like it, saying, and both of them are bloodthirsty, and both of them are never satisfied, like a leech. "There are three things that are never satisfied. Yea, four things say not, 'It is enough.'" Now, here we find this example of saying, there's two. No, three. No, actually, there's four. And throughout this chapter, we find several instances where that. He'll say, three things which are wonderful for me. No, four, which I know not. He'll say, there are four things, there are three things of the earth is disquieted, and four which it cannot bear. In an earlier chapter, in chapter 6, it said, there are six things the Lord hates. No, seven are an abomination to him. Now, the reason for that use, it looks almost at first like he was writing it down, said, I can think of six things the Lord hates. Oops, nope, I just thought of another one. There's seven, you know, and didn't correct, you know, just kind of corrected himself afterwards. But that's not how it happened. This is just a literary device to show the list is not exhaustive. There are others that he probably isn't even thinking of. First he thought of six, then he thought of seven. In this case, he said, the horse leech has two daughters. He thought of immediately two things that are like a leech, two things that are parasites, two things that never are satisfied. They said, no, I can think of three, actually. They said, no, four things that never say it's enough. So there's probably more than four, but he's just saying, these are some things that I thought of, and the list is not exhaustive. Here's the four. The grave, the barren womb, the earth that is not filled with water, and fire that saith not, it is enough. Well, the grave is never satisfied because there's always people dying and going to it. The womb, the barren womb is never satisfied because it's never full. And the earth is never filled with water, as the Psalms tell us, that when God made the dry land to appear, he set boundaries for the oceans. It says in several of the Psalms, he made boundaries for the seas and told them they could not pass over them. So the earth never quite gets filled up with water again, at least not since the flood. And then fire, of course, fire doesn't seem to ever be satisfied. You always have to put it out. As long as there's something else there to devour, it will do so. Then it says, "The eye that mocketh at his father and despiseth to obey his mother, the ravens of the valley shall pick it out, and the young eagles shall eat it." There are three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I know not. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. Now what he's saying is, there's four things that really he can't figure out. First of all, he can't figure out the path of an eagle in the air. I can't tell how he knows where he's going and what he's, you know, he doesn't leave a trail behind him or anything like that. The way of a serpent on the rock is the same way, really. The way of a ship in the midst of the sea, he doesn't know how to navigate. He doesn't know how they find their way either. And he doesn't understand the way man relates with a woman. Those are all very strange. Now, there's a similar passage to this in the Book of Wisdom, which is one of the apocryphal books of the Old Testament. And it's from Wisdom chapter 5, verses 10 through 11. And this is from the Jerusalem Bible. It says, "Like a ship that cuts through heaving waves, leaving no trace to show where it has passed, or like a bird flying through the air, leaving no proof of its passing." And then it goes on to say something else. But it's interesting, it points out the ship leaving no trail behind it, and the bird through the air, leaving no trail behind it. Those two things are found also in this list. And so he's saying that these are things that he doesn't understand their ways. Once they've flown, he's not sure where they've been. You can't see their trail exactly. The eagle doesn't leave a jet stream behind it. So such is the way of an adulterous woman. She eateth and wipeth her mouth and saith, I have done no wickedness. So she conceals her sin. For three things the earth is disquieted, and for four things it cannot bear. For a servant when he reigns, a fool when he is filled with meat, an odious woman when she is married, and a handmaid that is heir to her mistress. Now, he's just saying that these things are really hard to tolerate. The earth itself has a hard time tolerating these things. A servant when he reigns, that is, man who is raised as a servant, with a servant's mentality, and then is exalted all of a sudden to a position of rulership, he's suggesting that they can't really handle it, and that they're likely to get too proud. They've been exalted, like putting a novice in eldership. Also, it says a fool, when he's filled with meat, once a fool gets full, he says all his mouth, because getting full of meat makes people confident and talkative, usually. And an odious woman, when she's married, that's an unlovely woman. I think an unloved woman is the way some translations make it, when she's finally married. And an heir, a handmaid that's made heir to a mistress. In other words, when there's a situation where a person who's not usually given some honor, they get an honor. It's like a woman who's a church soloist in the little Baptist church down the street, and she's asked to sing at some great opera hall or something like that, you know. There'd be no living with her. And that's what it's saying. The earth is disquieted by these things. Some of these things are a little hard to figure what he's getting at. Verses 24 through 28. There be four things which are little upon the earth, but they are exceeding wise. The ants are a people not strong, yet they prepare their meat in the summer. The conies are but a feeble folk, yet they make their houses in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet they go forth, all of them, by bands or by armies. The spider taketh hold with her hands as in king's palaces. The word spider there, in verse 28, some translations, the New American Standard, for instance, changes it to lizard. And apparently the Hebrew word is not clear whether it's referring to a spider or a lizard. Both of them do take hold with their hands. Though in the New American Standard, verse 28 says, the lizard you may grasp with your hands. So it's a slightly different meaning. But he says these are four small things which manage to get by through their wisdom. And of course, we are small and weak in the universe. And yet, by the use of wisdom, we have become significant, or we are significant, because we have the knowledge of God and all. Now, here's the various types of wisdom, and this perhaps could be seen as four aspects of strategic survival. Because it's talking about small things that live in danger, in a dangerous world, but happen to make it and survive by their wits. One of them are the ants. They're not strong, it says. Well, they're not strong maybe because they're so small. They're pretty strong for their size. If you've ever seen an ant carrying a twig about four times its size, you know that ants are strong, very strong. But they're not strong in the sense that they can't pick up a human. They're a lot weaker than we are because they're small. But even though they're small and not strong enough to defend themselves against large animals and large enemies, yet they are smart, and they prepare their food in the summer, for the winter, that is, so that they survive. The conies are the rock hyrax, a little animal about the size of a rabbit that lives in the rocks over in Israel. And so they're feeble folk, but they make their houses in the rocks. That's pretty smart. They themselves are feeble. They seek shelter in the rocks. Locusts, even without a leader, they stick together and run together as an army. And the spider or the lizard, depending on which we take it to be, seems to be saying that it is in king's palaces because it takes hold with its hands, or else in spite of the fact that you could catch it in your hand. The taking hold with the hands. Apparently, the Hebrew could read either way. You could either say the lizard takes hold, or you could catch in your hand, as the New American Standard, or as in this case, the spider takes hold with its hands. In either case, though it's small and can be caught with your hand, it is nonetheless in king's houses, spiders and so forth. They make themselves places, even in king's palaces, by their wisdom. Partly maybe by their usefulness. Both of them eat insects. And I don't know whether kings in those days welcomed insect eaters into their homes or not, but I do. I don't mind spiders in my house. I'd rather have them than mosquitoes. And so by making themselves useful, perhaps, they have made a place for themselves. Now, we can apply these things to ourselves, of course, and see whether we're wise or not. We are weak folks. We are not strong. We don't have any king on earth. You know, we have Jesus as our king, but yet we can prepare for hard times. We can make our lodging in the rock, that is in Jesus, our rock. That's a wise move on the Coney's part. We should march as an army, that is, we should band together instead of being isolated from each other and trying to serve God just as individuals. And we can take hold with our hands, being king's palaces. We can make a place for ourselves by our wisdom. There's a lot of ways that last verse could be taken, I suppose, but I don't know how it's supposed to be taken. Verse 29, there are three things which go well, yea, four are comely in the way they go. That is, the way they move is a lovely thing. One of them is a lion, which is strongest among the beasts, and turneth not away for any. Next is a greyhound. Actually, the word greyhound there is the Hebrew mothin, which means literally slender loins. Some animal that has slender loins, but King James translators figured it was a greyhound because it's got slender loins. Jerusalem thinks it's a rooster. I don't know what it is. No one apparently knows what it is. Some animal called slender loins, but it could have been a rooster, could have been a greyhound, could have been some other slender loin animal. Might have been a cheetah. They have pretty slender loins also. At any rate, it says the greyhound or the slender loins, a he-goat also, and a king against him rising up. So a lion, a slender loins, a he-goat, and a king. All of them move with a certain air about them, with a certain comeliness to their way of moving. There's a certain dignity about them. If thou hast done foolishly in lifting up thyself, or if thou hast thought evil, lay thine hand upon thy mouth. That's, in other words, stop yourself from doing it again. Surely the churning of milk bringeth forth butter, and the wringing of the nose bringeth forth blood, so the forcing of wrath bringeth forth life. This guy, I'm glad we only have one chapter of his, but he's got some funny things to say. The churning of milk brings forth butter, the wringing of the nose brings forth blood, and so the stirring up, the forcing of wrath brings forth strife. Well, I don't have anything to say about that, except that, of course, in order for milk to become butter, it has to be agitated quite a bit. And a nose usually doesn't bleed until it's aggravated. And perhaps it's, what it's saying here is that strife can be avoided if we don't force wrath. If there's wrath, just to let it ride instead of forcing the issue. Well, anyway. Let's go to chapter 31, King Lemuel's prophecy. Now, the first nine verses might be the only part that King Lemuel wrote, because verses 10 through 31 about the virtuous woman are actually a separate poem, an acrostic poem. Each verse from verse 10 through 31 follows the Jewish alphabet. Each verse starts with a different letter of the Jewish Hebrew alphabet. And so it might have been written by someone else, and in the Hebrew Bible, I believe it's even placed in a different spot in the book of Proverbs, verses 10 through 31. But at least verses 1 through 9 were written by Lemuel, and it's not even his own, it's his mother's prophecy. His mother was a prophetess, I guess. It says, the word of King Lemuel, the prophecy that Israel taught him. What, my son? And what, the son of my womb? And what, the son of my vows? Sounds like a Jewish mother already. Give not thy strength unto women, nor thy ways to that which destroyeth kings. It is not for thee, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law, and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. Strong drink to him that is ready to perish, and wine unto those that are of a heavy heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. Open thy mouth for the dumb in the cause of all such as are appointed to destruction. Open thy mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor and needy. Now this is the advice King Lemuel's mother gave him. Many times the mother of a king was the queen. Well, she was the queen mother, and like Solomon's mother, Bathsheba, had special honors. He would sometimes set a throne right next to his for her. In fact, if King Lemuel was, like if that's a poetic name for Solomon, as some have suggested, which there's no evidence for, but could be true, then his mother here would be Bathsheba. And we know from other parts of the Bible that Bathsheba really had a high and honorable position in the government after her son became king. And so his mother's prophecy here would be taken very heavily, seriously by him. And what it is, basically, is a warning against women and wine. First of all, he says, don't give your strength to women or your ways to that which destroys kings. Now, if this advice was given to Solomon, he didn't take it very well, because he gave his strength to women. He did allow himself, the king, to be destroyed. If this was not Solomon, if Lemuel was some other man after the time of Solomon, then it might have even been Solomon who they had in mind when they thought of how women destroy kings. Because we know from the scriptures that Solomon married many foreign women and built shrines to their gods and their goddesses right in Jerusalem. And it says in the scriptures that his wives turned away his heart from God. So women can really destroy kings. Don't give your strength to them. And then she talks mainly about wine. She says wine isn't for kings. Wine is for people who are dying. If people are on their deathbed, if they're perishing, or if they're in the final throes of some agonizing disease, she says, well, give them wine. Go ahead and numb them to their pain. It's like giving some kind of anesthesia to someone who's suffering. That's what it's talking about there when it says, give strong drink to him that is ready to perish, and wine to those who are of a heavy heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. So the man who's almost dead and the man who's poor, let him be the wino, but not the king. We could see the motives for a wino, or for a beggar who's poor, to drink. It doesn't mean it's right for him to, but she said, leave that to those people. Leave the wine to the people in those conditions, the people who need it. Kings don't need that, and they certainly can't afford it. Because she says in verse 4, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes strong drink, lest they drink and forget the law and pervert the judgment of any of the afflicted. We need to understand that intoxication is not appropriate for anyone who's going to bear any kind of authority, because intoxicants befuddle the judgment. It says, lest you pervert judgment. In Hosea 4:4, it says that strong drink takes away the heart. Hosea 4:4, it says, oops, it must not, I thought it was Hosea 4:4. That's 2:4. Wait. Where is it here? This is surprising. 4:11. Sorry, 4:11. I've got it wrong in my notes. Whoredom and wine and new wine take away the heart, it says. Now the heart, you're supposed to keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. You need to keep your heart under control. You need to keep your mind straight, your head screwed on straight and everything. And wine takes away the heart. And I know that not only wine, but other kinds of drugs rob a person of moral judgment. And it says in another place in Proverbs that if you drink wine, it says your eyes will behold strange women and your mouth will utter perverse things. And so anyone who's going to bear authority must avoid all intoxication. That would include all Christians, of course, because we are to rule with Christ, and we are to be having dominion in this world. Now, we don't necessarily understand that as well as we need to, perhaps, but that is something the Bible declares to be true. God has called us to have dominion and to rule with Christ, and He's training us as rulers even now. That's what prayer is doing. It's helping, it's working together with God and making things happen in the world, ruling the world from our prayer closet. And that's it's needful for us to avoid intoxication, whether it be of alcohol or drugs. Now we get into verse 10, and the rest of that is a poem about the virtuous woman, or some would say the perfect wife. The Jerusalem Bible says the perfect wife. The New American Standard says the excellent wife. Who can find an excellent wife? Here it says a virtuous woman, or a good woman. Now this is not really a tribute to womanhood. It's just basically saying how rare it is to find a good one. It's not really saying that women are all bad. It's just whoever wrote this was feeling that it's not very common to find one who is as good as women can be. The woman that's described here is not supernatural. She is not otherworldly. She's not the kind of woman that that other women could not be. She's just it's just a description of women at their best. But what he says is it's unusual to find women at their best. It says their price is like rubies in verse 10, which means they're rare. The reason rubies are worth something is they're rare. Same with diamonds or anything else. If the whole world was made of them, you wouldn't get very much money for one. But when you can only find a few of them here and there, they have more value. And that what it's saying is it's unusual to find women who are at the best, at what women can be. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. Remember now I said each verse follows the pattern of the Hebrew alphabet. So that was Aleph. And then the next verse starts with Beth and then Gimel and so forth. Each verse progresses a little further through the alphabet. It's an acrostic poem. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her, so that he shall have no need of spoil. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeketh wool and flax and worketh willingly with her hands. She is like the merchant ships, her food from afar. She rideth also while it is yet night and giveth meat to her household and a portion to her maidens. She considereth a field and buyeth it, and the fruit of her hand she planteth a vineyard with the fruit of her hand. She girdeth her loins with strength and strengtheneth her arms. She perceiveth that her merchandise is good. Her candle goeth not out by night. She layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. She stretcheth out her hand to the poor. Yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow in her household. All her household are clothed with scarlet. She maketh herself coverings of tapestry. Her clothing is silk and purple. Her husband is known in the gates, when he sitteth among the elders of the land. She maketh fine linen, and selleth it, and delivereth girdles unto the merchant. Strength and honor are her clothing, and she shall rejoice in time to come. She openeth her mouth with wisdom, and in her tongue is the law of kindness. She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children rise up, and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praiseth her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all, they say. Favor is deceitful, beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. This lays out a pattern for all Christian women, basically, of what things consider to be virtuous in women. First of all, we're told certain things are not considered to be particularly of value. In verse 30, favor is deceitful and beauty is vain. Favor means charm. The New American Standard and the Jerusalem Bible both support the word charm for the first word in verse 30. So charm is deceitful. Beauty is vain. Those are not things of value. And yet those are the things that the world values in a woman. They're looking for someone who knows how to be charming, who knows how to charm a man, and a woman who's beautiful. Those things the world values, but he says those are things that we don't value. We're looking for a woman that fears the Lord. That's the one who's going to be praised. That's what has value. As it says in 1 chapter 3 and verse 7, that she is adorned with the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. Not what man necessarily has always valued in women, but what God values. That's more important. And it's a meek and quiet spirit, not charm and beauty. Okay, well, let's go through this and see a few things about it. The first thing to learn of her is that she's good to her husband. Verse 11. The heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. There's a lot of men who trust their wives, but not safely. There's a lot of women who don't live up to their husband's trust. Now, in all fairness, I have to say there's a lot of men, and perhaps more men than women, who don't live up to their spouse's trust. There are many trusting wives whose husbands are totally unfaithful and untrustworthy. But Solomon says that in another place. He said, many will proclaim his own righteousness, but a faithful man who can find? Okay, it's not easy to find a faithful man. But he's saying here it's not easy to find a faithful woman either. Who can find one of these women? Her husband can safely trust in her. He can trust in her and he won't lose by it. It's safe because she's trustworthy. So that he shall have no need of spoil. It won't be necessary for him to get rich. He'll consider himself rich enough just having a faithful wife. She will do him good and evil all the days of her life. Further, with reference to how she's good to her husband, in verse 23 it says, her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. Now what that means is that because a man has a virtuous wife, he is elevated to the gates. The gates were the places where the rulers, the judges would sit. And the people would come and bring their cases to the judges sitting in the gates. It says, her husband is known in the gates when he sitteth among the elders of the land. This tells us, first of all, that her virtuousness crowns him with authority in his community. Having a virtuous wife, the right kind of wife, will elevate her husband to a position of respect and leadership. It says in Proverbs 12:4, a virtuous woman, a virtuous wife is a crown to her husband, meaning that she elevates him. He's crowned by her. He's brought to a position of authority, as a crown signifies. His role as a leader is dependent upon her. According to 1 Timothy 3:11, a church leader has to have a virtuous wife. 1 Timothy 3:11, his wife has to be of certain character. It's not only the leader himself, but his wife. So that her virtuous character makes it possible for him to sit with the elders in the gate. And of course we know that because she's virtuous, she also makes him a better leader because she contributes to his spiritual condition. It says in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1, that says, likewise, you wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that if any of your husbands do not obey the word, they may be won by the behavior of their wives. They behold your chaste behavior coupled with fear. Meaning that the woman, she's a crown to her husband. That is, his reputation is good because he has a virtuous wife. She qualifies him for leadership because without a virtuous wife, he's unqualified for eldership. And thirdly, she enhances his own spiritual walk, which makes him a better leader, so that her husband is known in the gates. It's suggesting that if a woman is a virtuous woman, her husband will be known in the gates, and he will be sitting with the elders, implying that it's very, behind every good man, there's a good woman, as they say. But it's a direct cause and effect kind of situation that it implies here. Okay, going down further, she seeks wool and flax and so forth. It means that she's involved getting the best bargain. She's saving her husband money. She doesn't have expensive taste necessarily, but she's looking for good merchandise. It says in verse 18, she perceives that her merchandise is good. Now, she's depicted as one who makes the clothes for her family. And as she's industrious, that's one of the main things we find about her, besides the fact that she's faithful to her husband, we find that she's industrious. She works hard. She gets up before it's even daytime, it says in verse 15. She arises also while it is yet night and gives meat to her household. Also, it tells us in verse 18 that her candle does not go out at night, meaning that she keeps the candle burning late at night while she continues to sew clothing and stuff. So she's not lazy, unlike a lot of modern women who in America so much leisure time, they don't have to work very hard, and so they develop like some men do, although most men have to do a little more work. Not that women don't work hard. I suppose some women would object to my saying men don't have to do more work. Women have to do a lot of work too. Raising kids and keeping house is work. But realize that women now have conveniences to do those things that make their work a lot easier than the women who had to do those same things before without running water and without electric vacuum cleaners and without, all the things that make it more convenient, washing machines and things. So that in modern times, it's common to find housewives who just sit around and watch TV and eat bonbons all day long, you know, because they don't have to do quite as much work to keep their house up. And yet the virtuous woman is industrious. She works hard. She doesn't oversleep. She gets up before the rest of the family so that she can prepare her meals. Nowadays, they can do it a lot faster. But in those days, she'd have to go out and she'd have to get a coal from somewhere and start a fire in the stove and then start cooking stuff up. And it would be quite a lengthy process. So she'd have to get up even before dawn so that by the time her family got up, she could have food ready. And it says that in verse 16, it says she considers a field and buys it. This is not saying that she's in real estate or something like that, or has a career in real estate. What it's saying is that she buys a field so that she can plant it and all. Her husband's busy doing other things, so she's always looking out for the advancement of the family, seeing, okay, here's a field. She considers, is this going to be profitable for the family? She'll buy it, and then she works it with her own hands. It says she plants a vineyard. And when it says in verse 17, she girds her loins with strength, and strengtheneth her arms. The Jerusalem Bible says she puts her back into her work and shows how strong her arms can be. So it seems that when the Bible calls the woman the weaker vessel, it's not referring to her being physically weak. There are other senses in which the Bible uses that term, the weaker vessel. But she's not necessarily weak physically. She actually works hard and she has strength in her arms. In verse 18, where it says she perceives that her merchandise is good, the Hebrew word perceive is actually the word for taste. She tastes that her merchandise is good. We get the picture of her going around buying food for the family in the marketplace and tasting things to see if she's getting the good stuff for her family. Then we find that she's generous. Again, we need to find more women like this. She stretches out her hand, verse 20, to the poor. Yea, she reaches forth her hands to the needy. She's not insecure about her own family. She's not afraid for the snow to come. She herself provides the clothes by making them. So she's very busy. She's not greedy. Many women are much more greedy than their husbands, at least in Christianhood. I've sometimes seen that many times a husband wants to go off and sell everything and follow the Lord on the mission field, but the woman, because of her upbringing or whatever, because of her concern for the children or whatever, doesn't feel very free to do that. I'm not saying this is true of all. I'm just saying that I've seen this in many cases where a man will want to forsake his property or will want to give to the poor or something, and where a woman who is insecure doesn't go for that. But a virtuous woman is not insecure. She's not afraid about her family's future. She's taking care of them with her own hands. And furthermore, she gives to the poor and is not clinging to her possessions. And there's other verses there that talk about how she makes clothing. Verses 21, 22, 24, she makes fine linen and so forth. But though she makes that kind of clothing, her real clothing is in verse 25. Strength and honor are her clothing. It's like the Bible talks about being clothed with righteousness. So the real clothing that she has on, she's not so much adorning her outward man, she's adorning the inward man. Her real clothing and ornamentation is her honor and her strength. And she shall rejoice in time to come. She also opens her mouth with wisdom, and her tongue is in her tongue is the law of kindness. It's again, like it says, it's rare and really fine to find women who are always speaking kindly and wisely. She never eats the bread of idleness, verse 27 says. That means she doesn't ever have idle time on her hands. She's always busy doing important, useful things. Now, she receives praise from her children, verse 28 and 29 say, and her husband. They praise her. They praise her and they say that many others have done virtuously, but you excel them all. Favor is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman that fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Then it says in verse 31, give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. The reference to the fact that a woman's works will praise her. We find New Testament examples of that. In Mark 14, when Mary broke the vessel of spikenard and poured it over Jesus, and she was criticized for it by Judas, who said this could have been sold and the money given to the poor. Jesus said, don't don't bother her. She said, this thing she's done will be spoken about her everywhere. He says, everywhere the gospel is preached, this good work that she has done, she'll be spoken of her. So her works praise her after her. Dorcas in Acts chapter 9 was a woman who did good deeds. The Bible says she was full of alms deeds and good deeds that she did. She made clothes for people. Dorcas in chapter 9 of Acts, in verse 39, was a virtuous woman of this type. And after she died, Peter came to visit. All the people showed all the things Dorcas had done. They showed him the clothing that she'd made and all. And her works continued to praise her, even after she was finished. Phoebe is another one, found in Romans 16:1. She was had a ministry of hospitality, and Paul spoke well of her for her works. Her works praised her also. Also, the church itself is a virtuous woman, supposed to be. We are the bride of Christ. Christ deserves a virtuous wife. He deserves a virtuous bride. And our works are supposed to praise us also. It says in Revelation 19, verses 7 through 8, that the white linen of the church is the righteous deeds of the saints. So the beautiful white linen of the marriage day with Christ is made up of our good deeds. And our deeds, our works, shall praise us in the gates. Now, another thing, applying this to the church, of course, if you go through this whole thing and see that the church is supposed to be a virtuous wife for Christ, you can see a lot of things that where we lack. One of them is that it says, the heart of her husband doth safely trust in her. She will do him good and not evil all the days of her life. I'm afraid the church hasn't always done Christ good and no evil all the days of its life. Nor has it always lived up to his trust. He's entrusted us with a great deal to carry out his purposes on earth in his absence. We haven't always lived up to his trust. His heart has not safely been able to trust in us. Though he has trusted us, it hasn't been safe. And we haven't always done him good all the days of his life. Another thing about it, in verse 15, she rises also while it is yet night and giveth meat to her household. I believe that it's necessary for us to give meat to the household of Christ. Jesus said in Matthew 25, blessed is that servant whom his master shall find so doing, giving meat to his household in due season. That is spiritual meat. We are to be giving out the Word of God to the household of God. But we may need to rise early to prepare that food. I know that for me, even to give any kind of a teaching, I need to rise up real early to just seek the Lord, spend time alone with the Lord, and just prepare the food to give to the household. And I know that that's what we as Christians need to do more often, is to get up early and seek the Lord for nourishment ourselves so that we will have something to give to others in the day. These are attributes of a virtuous wife, and certainly Jesus deserves a virtuous wife. And, of course, the whole idea of being industrious, active, productive for him. These are the things a wife does for her husband and what the church should be doing for Christ.